Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 33 on Tuesday, the 29th of March, 2016. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, this is just about Andrew.
Just about. We may both survive to the end of tonight's recording.
I think I sound worse than I feel, and you feel worse than you sound.
It is a little bit like that. It's ill men talk about cars tonight. So yeah, let's try ramp on with it rather before we both expire. There is some follow up from last week, Andrew.
Yeah, so we talked about the 74th members meeting, and ITV4, which is what they usually do, will be showing highlights starting this Thursday on the 31st of March at 9 o'clock on ITV4. Again on Friday, the 1st of April at 8 p.m., Saturday the 2nd at 7:15 in the morning for all you early birds or people who have children, and then Sunday the 3rd at 6:15 in the evening. It will also go on to ITV, which will be on Tuesday the 5th of April at 20 to midnight. Mm-hmm. There will be a link in the show notes to this so you can actually catch these times again. But do go watch.
Or at the very least, set your televisual recording device of choice to actually catch up with that. I'm looking forward to seeing some of that. Hopefully it'll be on the ITV hub player thingy, because I still haven't actually got my television connection sorted out. I think that was it for follow-up for the moment. I think something else I need to follow up on later on, but never mind, we shall come to that when we come to it. But last week was also the start of the 2016 New York Motor Show, and whilst quite a lot of the stuff being shown there was for the North American market, there's quite a few things that are relevant for all of us. First, and absolutely not least, was probably the vehicle which caught, which got more press time here in the UK than just about anything else. And that was a small car which I'm slightly familiar with, but with a twist. It's the Mazda MX-5 RF, the retractable fastback version of the MX-5. So that's the one with the foldy hard top, essentially.
And it looks so much better with the hard top.
With the roof up, it looks very good with the hard top. I agree. With the roof down, so whereas the last version, the NC model, everything disappeared under the rear sort of tonneau thing, the sort of rope, you know, it would lift stuff and buzz and click, and then everything would disappear. On this version, the kind of C pillar. Pillars remain, and it really is the C pillars that remain in sort of two buttresses, much like on an XJS. And I think it looks a bit odd with the roof down. To be from the side, it looks a bit odd with the roof down. And my real worry is that will intrude on that the whole sort of top down feeling.
That's as much top-down feeling as I want. After spending a week of hacking away with a cough, that's as much top-down as I want.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll come to the sort of, yes, possibly one of the reasons why we do both have colds later on. Yeah, well.
I was being very flippant. I do know what you mean. When I heard about a hardtop, I was expecting it to be fully retractable rather than sort of Targa top-esque. Yeah. And I think it would have looked neater if... Because from this, I don't think it looks bad from the side. It's when you go to the back, come at the back three-quarters at an angle, that you suddenly go, oh, hang on. But they've left half the roof there.
Uh-huh. I was expecting that bit to be all filled in. So I was expecting it to be a kind of solid back on that bit and maybe a hatchback or something in there, or it to be a hardtop coupe, which I think would have been absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
It would have been cool. It would have been something slightly different. I just, I'd like to drive it and see, and I'd like to see it in the flesh as well before I make any sort of really outlandish comments about it. The theater of the way that it folds and everything, like the 991 Targa, and the way that whole bit lifts up and then everything folds away in and into the equivalent space to where my soft top goes, I think's fab. I think that's going to be really lovely. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I will. We'll hopefully be making enough of a stir with Mazda that maybe we get to drive one before they hit dealerships. But if not, then I'll be trotting around to my dealership of choice and having a shotty as soon as I possibly can.
I wonder, is the way that the hardtop roof set up because they don't want to take up any of the boot space?
Yeah, boot space is the
because if you had a full. I would have preferred a full coupe hardtop. Mm-hmm. No bits coming down. But if you are going to take metal roofs down, obviously one of your major problems is how much space that takes up compared to a concertina fabric roof.
Yeah.
So I can see sort of why they've done it that way. But like I say, I'd rather just a full hardtop.
My sister's on her second of the previous generation foldy hardtops.
Okay.
And the way they get away with it there is actually the whole rear deck is different between the soft top and the hard top. You don't notice it unless you see them beside each other.
All right.
Because she and I had almost identical models before, only hers was the foldy hard top, mine was the foldy soft top. And the whole rear deck was different. On this, it looks like most of the rear deck is identical. But again, I can't see until they're beside each other. There are a couple of benefits in the new one, though, and that's that you can open and close the roof at up to 6 miles an hour, which is kind of cool. That's a bit of a difference. It used to be quite difficult. You had to sort of stop. You had to basically be the first at the traffic lights to get it down or up whilst the roof was before the traffic light turned green again. Which caught people out. I know Jane got caught out by that at least once. But in the UK, the foldy hardtop made up about 80% of sales of the previous generation. Globally, the split's expected to be 50-50 this time around. So we'll see a lot of them around on the roads, I think. Here in the UK, certainly.
Yep.
But yeah, looking forward to seeing that. Oh, you'll also be able to get an auto as well. That's the one of the other big differences, is that there will be an automatic available in the foldy hardtop. And those of us purists with the foldy softtop will stick with our fab 6-speed manual.
Oh, yes, it's not a real one if you don't have the manual.
I don't really say that. I don't really believe that either. I think, I'd be interested to try it again. I am absolutely not one of these. It's an auto. It's not a proper person's car. He's obviously not too ill that he can't do silly voices.
They're just emphasized. Right, let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on.
To a cartoon character.
Oh, I know.
Godzilla.
The Nissan GTR, beloved of successful bouncers everywhere and Fast and Furious fans who haven't grown up yet. Has had a couple of small changes. It has had literally the smidgen of a facelift. It has a new V grille to make it tie in with more of the rest of the Nissan range. It's got new bumpers and a new metallic orange paint. Inside, for people like Andrew who love these things, there's fewer buttons and a bigger touchscreen, and it's expected to cost about the same $78,000 as it currently costs.
It's also supposed to be nicer inside as well.
Meh.
As in the comfort and materials, et cetera, et cetera, supposed to be improved.
Yeah, it's meant to be a little bit more ride comfort in there too.
We've got one of these, a blue one of these close to us, and it looks fantastic in the blue. I mean, they've got presence. I mean, if you take away the people being stupid and fast and furiousness about it, it's an amazing technical achievement.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please don't get my flippancy about that kind of thing take away from the technical achievement of the car, because it is a proper four-seater that will go properly fast and handle properly well. Much smaller, although in a kind of similar vein, really, is the Toyota GT86. My apologies to Buddha PSL for saying that you drove one of these. It does, of course, drive the near identical, this was my other follow-up, the near identical Toyota BRZ. But no word on how the facelift of the GT86 will affect the BRZ. Again, we discussed it last week, really. It's got new bumpers and LED, and LED lights all round. It's got new alloys. There's some refinement to inside to try and move the interior a little bit more upmarket than the current versions, which could be doing with a little bit of refinement, we're working on. They seem to have covered that. That's been one of the sort of road testers' critiques of it.
The pictures I've seen from there, of the silver one or the metallic grey or whatever
color it looks, it's much called, nicer.
It looks really good. I do like that. I do like what they've enhanced on that. It's more aggressive, but not in a ridiculous way. You know what I mean? They haven't they haven't gone to Halfords and gone, quick, we need a big wing, we need this, we need that. I mean, it's all the tweaks seem to be in proportion.
It's got rid of a lot of the fussiness that was in that car. It was always just a little bit too effeminate. This has just butched it up a little bit, and I think it looks great. I've still never driven one. It did get as far as my shortlist last time around, but I still never quite got as far as driving it. Toyota made no changes to the engine, as far as anyone knows. So it's just the same output, just the same exhaust system and everything. But the suspension has been slightly reprofiled.
Ding. Drink one.
Oh.
And the Camp European siren.
Oh, that's allowable.
The criteria is, would I want my children to hear it and repeat it when we are in Tesco's? No.
Okay, fair enough. That was borderline. I'll give you that. One of these weeks. It's 1 week I'll be doing the editing. So basically it's refinements on an already successful package. On there.
Yeah.
Next up, again, lots of Japanese stuff, bizarrely, for the New York Motor Show. Subaru showed an Impreza concept, which I thought we talked about this months ago. To be
in Tokyo, honest. Didn't we?
I think so, yeah.
We talked about it then. I think it's the first time it's gone outside of Tokyo.
Yeah, I think so, because it definitely wasn't at Geneva. I did go have a good look. Instead, there was the XV concept. The one thing that's notable about this new Impreza concept is that they have announced that it sits on a new standardized Subaru platform, which I think is going to underpin pretty much everything from the Outback, the Forester, Impreza XV, obviously not the BRZ, BRZ as well, if we're going to be all American about it. That's really the big news there, is Subaru are going to standardize on the platform, which doesn't seem a huge surprise to me. I'm surprised they're not already doing it.
Yeah, because they are an independent car manufacturer, so you would have expected them to have done something like that already. But I was looking at the wrong pictures then. Anyway, I was looking at the LA show one from last year.
Oh right, okay.
So
it's still a good looking vehicle.
Spit. All right. I find it just a bit bland. I was hoping for more.
Yeah, I think that was the discussion last time. I mean, I did say it was good looking as opposed to handsome or attractive.
I prefer the hatchbacky estatey one, the five door, as opposed to the saloon.
And that's why I've not gone into much detail here, because they're not really likely to sell the saloon here, and we'll get the hatchbacky five doory version.
That doesn't look too bad, if you put it up against cars of that size, it doesn't stand out, does it?
No. You don't buy a Subaru for its looks, though, which is just as well. Otherwise, it wouldn't really have sold that much in this country.
There were a couple of generations where that was a blessing rather than...
yes. Yeah, you buy it for its technical ability and its reliability and its off-roadiness and all the things which Subaru are awesome at.
Yeah.
Speaking of vehicles that don't look that great, God, the new Merc GLC Coupe was also unveiled. It's essentially an X4 with a three-pointed star. If you really want the GLE ugliness without quite all of the cost, although it still starts at 38 grand, then this is a vehicle for you. I'm sorry for this one. I'm not opening up the pictures on my laptop because, quite frankly, I think it is hideous and just, it's so far out of the sphere of anything I would ever buy on so many levels.
Okay, I've got a request of manufacturers.
Yeah, go on.
Manufacturers who think the coupe-style SUV is the niche to go down, stop it. No one wants to see it. Enough of it. I'm looking at you, Mercedes and BMW. Enough of it.
Do you hear that? You're making a sick man very angry.
It's probably best I am sick because I was.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't have to actually bleep myself at
really
this
shanky.
Point. But there's no need for it. It doesn't. It doesn't hit any need. It's not sporty, and it doesn't do SUV enough. Mm-hmm. So don't do it. Fine if you want to make coupe cars. That's no problem because some cars can look good as coupes and some people want sleek two-door, hidden four-door things. That's absolutely no problems with that at all. And people want big SUVs or medium-sized SUVs. But what people don't go is, oh, yeah, can I have that just a bit higher? No, no one says that. So please stop making them. Do the world a favour and just kill that niche off for the sake of good taste.
In time, they're all automatic. They're all four-wheel drive at the minute. In time, they will be offering this abomination in rear-wheel drive and with a manual gearbox. I can understand rear-wheel drive. I don't understand why anyone would want to buy that with a manual gearbox. So,
for the driver dynamics?
Yeah, well, quite exactly.
Mounting the pavement outside schools.
Meanwhile, but yeah, on a similar vein, Lincoln unveiled a concept showing some of the things that they're looking to put into the next generation of the incredibly good seller, the Lincoln Navigator, which is essentially the big posh upmarket version of the Ford Explorer. And yeah, they've come out with a concept. Really, the Navigator is all about the interior, and to try and show off the interior as best as they can, they fitted the concept with very, very large, totally impractical gullwing doors and side steps that come out so that people could see and get in.
Oh, you mean that wasn't just there for fat, lazy people who can't actually climb into a car?
It wasn't just there for fat, lazy people who can't actually climb into a car.
And just in case anyone hasn't noticed, I'm perhaps not a fan of this one either, because in profile, if you look at the silhouette, they've just stolen Range Rover.
Yeah, they have, quite badly. Before Ford that bothered about doing that kind of thing, let's face it, come on, they've basically stolen Aston Martin for much of the current Ford range. They'll probably tell you that they've paid for that shape, so they're going to go off and use it. I looked at this. I noticed it had only a tiny 3.5-litre twin-turbo V6. I went off to see what kind of ridiculous capacities the current Lincoln Navigator was available with. And it turns out you can actually only get it with a 3.5-litre twin-turbo V6 EcoBoost engine, which kind of surprised me, to be honest.
What I don't understand is what they were trying to claim, that this is a futuristic interior. I'm perhaps missing something on the futuristicness.
Well, many Lincoln... I don't know. I think it was just, 31-way adjustable seats and internal entertainment systems, all these kind of things. I think that's what they were showing.
Right, okay.
It's a New York motor show.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously no taste or style has been used at all in the design of this car. And it has absolutely no attraction to anybody that we know or would listen to this program. I hope the steps down is just a thing to allow people in on the motor show and is not going to be a future feature that comes to cars. Because if you can't step up into a car, go away from cars. Go back in, go jump into something else. will be rolled down the street physically by your minions, but you don't need to get in a car if you're that, if you can't step into something like that. And there goes rant two.
Right. You're done.
I think so. That made me so cross when I saw it.
I tried to head that one off at the pass, everyone, but I failed slightly. So I'm now going to fill in with the rest of it after that. The thing about the Navigator, right, is that Lincoln no longer make the town car, as far as I'm aware. So they no longer make those professional vehicles. So in New York, many Lincoln Navigators you see are essentially the equivalent of the black limos. So really they're trying to show off the kind of limo type stuff that they would put in the next generation of essentially a posh taxi and posh Ubers, which would appeal to many of the fleets in New York. I, as far as I can tell, that's what this concept is aimed at. It's aimed at that professional range.
Yeah, because what you need when you're trying to travel around New York is you need something the size of a small house to nip through those little gaps.
Or to just push the other stuff out of the way. You really need the... As someone who has tried to drive a Chrysler Neon through New York, because that's a sensible thing to do.
God, you've had all the best cars in America when you've gone there.
They get sucky rentals. I swear, next time I'm going to spend a flaming fortune on them and try and get some decent. Yeah, it's always some kind of Chrysler. Unless it's the a Hyundai, the 1.6 litre automatic Hyundai Accent. Whee! I always get rotten cars in the US. If you're getting an Uber in New York, which is, everyone will know, is the sensible way to get around New York City, chances are it'll be something like a Navigator that shows up to pick you up. Other thing about this that's really notable is it has a wardrobe management system for carrying clothes and luggage. Okay. Shall we move on?
Yes.
I think that's a good idea.
Yes.
I think it's just a couple of minutes ago.
Yes.
The other thing that was unveiled in New York, which to me is a little bit of, look over here, look at the big shiny thing, and which I think probably would have made more sense to unveil in Geneva rather than New York, was the Audi R8 Spider.
No, I disagree. I totally know why they released it there.
Well, it's a big show-off. Look at the shiny thing over here. Don't look at the diesels. Look at the shiny thing.
They need some positive press out there.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
And that's what this was all about. And I think it looks good.
It looks
I mean,
all
I know
right.
I just interrupted you, but I really like the front grille on these. I don't like the yellow, but I like the front grille. All the pictures seem to be yellow for some reason.
I'm just not a fan of the R8, and it's nothing to do with the R8. I'm sorry. It's to do with the... it just always seems to be like the supercar light for people who sort of want to think they want a supercar.
No, you see, I disagree. I think it is, until the new NSX comes out, I think it's the NSX of now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the supercar you can drive every day. It's the one that will work all the time, that doesn't require ridiculousness at every step of the way. You know, you don't have to compromise all over the place. I think this is, I think Audi have done a fantastic job of distilling what is it that most people want out of a supercar, taking that and giving it to people at a flipping reasonable price, actually. When you compare them.
I think that you're right. I wish you were. I think you are.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, Alan, but...
No, it's okay. It'd be boring if we agreed on everything or even anything. I just feel it's the sort of slightly posery version of the supercar light, but I
reckon if you got behind the wheel and you drove it, I think you would still feel super special in the way it went and the way it sounded.
The thing is... Your argument is valid. Depressingly, I know that you're right as well. Yeah, totally. I agree. Next up, it's a vehicle which confuses me slightly, actually. But it has some fantastic numbers. And it's the Toyota Prius plug-in hybrid, which, unlike the last Toyota Prius plug-in hybrid, which was just a Toyota Prius with an extra lap for plugging in, this position is completely different car this time. It's essentially looks like it's the same central body, but with reprofiled bumpers and front and back. They're claiming 202 miles per gallon and 32 grams per kilometer in output on this, but they're also trying to say that this is This is more of a true driver's car with a more engaging driving position and coupe-like cabin. Pardon me, and coupe-like cabin layout. The bits where I've done the weird emphasis are really, you know, quoted straight out of the autocar story on this. It's the plug-in one. It's meant to be the even lower output one, but it's meant to be the sporty Prius as part of the sort of Toyota's Prius range. It's not just the aesthetics. They have actually done proper mechanical changes. So, for example, it has double wishbone rear suspension instead of the sort of trailing arm setup on of the standard Prius we all know and love, even in its latest generation. So, besides the plug-in hybrid, the cleaner one is going to be the driver's Prius. Perfect for New York.
Last week or the week before, we were talking about the sporty SUV and how I felt they've got the looks of that really right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm completely the other way with the Prius. I really struggle with the looks of this. I'm not a fan of the whatever the design language is. I'm not a fan of what they're doing here. If you look at pictures in profile, the back wheels look like they are significantly smaller than the front wheels due to masses of metal around them.
And that's purely down to aerodynamics.
Yeah, no, I understand it's all engineered in and everything, I'm not a fan of the look of it. There's one element I do like around the back is where there's a slight kink in the rear wing or sort of half vertical, half sloping back window, a little bit like the Civic is at the moment. Where they've got the sort of split window, rear window. I quite like that, but there's so many swoops and slashes in this that you sort of
I don't think you buy one of these for the aesthetics.
But then I think they're missing a trick because this is my theory anyway about hybrids is that I think, say, the Outlander does very, very, Mitsubishi's Outlander does very, very well as a plug-in hybrid, or FEV, because it looks virtually identical to the normal one. Mm-hmm. If you want people to adopt a new technology, don't make them stand out, particularly if it's a car, because people buying cars are conservative with a small C, and they don't want to stand out too much, or the only way they want to stand out is, oh, look, I've got that badge.
I think you're only getting half the story. I think there is a market for some of these hybrids where people want to go, look, I'm driving a hybrid. Look how wonderful I am. I'm driving an electric car. And I think that, again, your argument is valid. I think there's the other side too.
But I think that's only a small proportion. I think for most people, to encourage them to get in, because this is where I have slight problems with the Leaf and the Zoe, is they look different. You know you're going to the electric car.
The BMW i3 is the same. It is.
But I think they've done it in such an extreme way that you go, oh, that's the electric one that BMW do. Oh, that. I know I'm sound like I'm contradicting myself here, but I think the way they've done, when you look at the i8, you go, wow, you know, oh, look, that's the future. Whereas I think the Zoe, the Leaf, the Prius, they all look close enough to a car to stand out for not looking like the typical car.
Yeah, but if you go down that, then you end up with the, oh, what's the one I can never remember the name of? There was a Renault Fluence ZE. I don't know if you ever saw one on the road. I think I only ever saw two in central London. And it was just like the dullest saloon car you could imagine, but it happened to be electric.
You look out there now, and a typical combustion engine, there are certain ones that we look at and we go, that looks a great looking car. That's a great looking car. They've got the proportions right. They've put the, you know, the flame language or whatever's going on with the slashes and the swoops and everything.
Yeah.
They've got that right. Whereas this typical combustion engine car, they have not got the look right. And I think...
Look, can we hold for a European spec one, please?
I know this is American.
The more I look at this, the more ridiculous those wheels look. And I just don't think we'd get them that size here in the UK. I think that there would be changes between the North American spec and the Euro spec on this one. I have nothing to back that up.
I tell you what I actually want to do. I'd like to spend some significant time with one of these rather than point from a distance and go, I don't like it, because I'm concerned I may be falling into a convenient trap. And I'm not a hater of technology.
No.
I really am not. I think some of the stuff that's happening with engines and engine management systems and stuff like that, I think it's just amazing and it's fantastic. And it just makes cars... you put up against my car that's 15 years old to now, and it's astounding how far we've come in that time. Mm. It truly is astounding how far we've come in that time. So for me to sit here and nitpick about looks, and they are massively important, because they are what will make someone walk through the door. It doesn't matter what your spec sheet says. If someone doesn't like the look of it, they're not going to walk through your showroom door and say, please take my money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I would like to better understand it and what it's all doing.
Yeah.
That's not going to stop me pointing and saying things, though. But I think it would... I need to give it a fair shake of the stick when we know more about the British or the European specs.
Yeah. And I don't think you're wrong. I don't think you're wrong at all.
The exterior looks are not going to change in that time, but I think the two...
I don't know. The standard Prius, the North American version, does seem to look to me different from the European version. I don't know if it's just because the ones that... the pictures in the edition of Car and Driver I was reading the other week just don't have a front number plate, or if there is actually a difference to the front of the car. I mean, I know that that Todd Baker in Newfoundland, who listens to the show, he was off his RAV4 was in his dealership, and he was looking at it, and he posted pictures in a forum that we're both on, and I just thought it looked a bit odd. Odder than the UK market cars. So, and the only thing I could pick out really was the lack of front number plate. So I don't know if that's what it is or if it's something slightly different. Anyway, shall we move on to one of the
things? Yeah, sorry, I waffled for an incredibly long time there on that. Right. Sorry if I was apologizing.
Change. It makes a change in being you and not me.
Yeah, me with my throat.
So, yeah. Well, keep talking then.
Yes, so... At the New York Motor Show, Carlos, how do you pronounce his surname?
I think it's Ghosn. I've never really heard it pronounced.
The CEO of Renault Nissan has stated that they will be coming out with autonomous cars. That's important. Mass market autonomous cars by 2020. Now, I checked my calendar, and that gives him 3 and a bit years.
Yes.
Which is interesting because legislation's going to have to move a little bit quicker.
Yeah. He also said that they were lobbying like mad around the world to make it legal. And I'm quoting the Autocar article here, to make it legal for a driver to take the hands off the wheel and do something else. But he expects that to be resolved by 2020.
We're not talking that. You are sitting in the back seat while the car drives you along. We're not talking about that.
He is.
Well,
no, he is.
But not for 2020.
He's trying to. He's trying to. I don't think he thinks he'll manage it by 2020, but I think that's really what he's trying for, I think. According to this, yeah.
Yeah, and what do they define as mass market as well?
Well, there's no definition of sort of prices or anything like that. I think he's just, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. I imagine he's in between 20 and 30 grand.
And legally, I think that's a massive ask. Unless they have been busily squirreling away in bunkers and not announcing any news whatsoever about how far they are down the line of autonomous driving.
Well, it says here that he made the distinction between autonomous cars and driverless ones, saying that he expects the car to be able to drive itself through a city with the driver's hands off the wheel by 2020, but with the driver being able to take back full control at any time. So you're right, it's not absolutely sit in the back. Sit in the back and read the paper. It is being able to sit back, let it do its thing, but keeping an eye on it. Yeah, full driverless cars with the driver not in the front seat, but much further off, he said. So my apologies, you're right, Andrew. Yes, absolutely.
That's three times twice. In one show. I'm going to have a lie down.
Just here and slap myself for 5 minutes and try to make up for that. It's unbelievable. So, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what they do, because they are pushing boundaries with their electric cars. So
absolutely. Yeah. He also did a couple of bits and pieces. Said another couple of bits and pieces. He declared it unlikely that Renault and Nissan would build cars for tech companies, and also that tech companies... He also said it was unlikely that tech companies would build cars due to the high investment and low margins, which they're just not accustomed to.
Totally disagree. I totally disagree with that last statement of his. I know you didn't. Sorry. I was apologizing. I wasn't trying to imply that you were there. But I've heard this mentioned before. And I think what the tech companies will do is come out and go, we have no baggage, no history. We're looking at all the possible technology that you could use, all the possible materials. Oh, look what Gordon Murray's doing. That sounds quite clever. I'm sure we can replicate that because we know about manufacturing processes and replicating things and using parts on other parts. Mm-hmm. It's what we were discussing when we talked about the article about the Marchionne saying, you know, just we're targeting high ticket cars at the moment because we'll be caught out with the low ones. There's no future in small margin cars.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, because I think he, well, that interpretation of his statements on that article was saying, oh, he can see that people are looking at different materials and different ways of building things.
Mm-hmm.
So, if he's adamant at that, then I worry for Renault Nissan, because I think they won't see the tech companies coming in then, because the tech companies are coming in and they want to produce autonomous cars that they can flog to Uber or Lyft or whoever.
Do they, or do they just want the patents on it and then to be able to license that out to existing manufacturers? That's the challenge, you see. That's the flip side.
Interesting. I think that's suggest a discussion for another day. My massive knowledge and insider dealings in all these things that has happened over many years, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is some of them would want to control.
Yeah.
The product that comes out, some would be happy to license that off.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Yeah. Damn, I want to stop saying that.
That's four. It's going to be a record. Oh my God. Anyway, quick, before we agree some more, let's move on.
Yes, quickly. Here in the UK, the Parliamentary Transport Committee has suggested that we should have more average speed cameras.
Now, before we all jump up and down, why did they suggest that, Alan?
To catch and encompass more offences undetected by the fact that there are fewer traffic police on the roads.
So there was a legitimate reason for this. Could be polite here. Statement.
Suggestion. Yeah.
However, I think, and we may strangely be about to be agreeing again, but
can I say it first and then agree with me, please?
Oh, yes, sorry. I don't want to hog it all.
Wouldn't it be better if you're trying to catch people who are committing offences which aren't being detected because there aren't enough traffic police. Wouldn't it be better, people, to invest in more flaming traffic police?
You know, Alan, I think you're right there.
I'm so glad you said so, Andrew. It just beggars belief that people would go off and that they would try and put in this huge infrastructure where the great thing about more traffic police is that they're a fantastic deterrent. I saw a few. Since the last time we spoke, I've driven a few thousand miles around the UK. And I've not seen a huge number, but where I have, I've actually been really pleased to see genuine proper traffic police. Because people just
buck
up their driving, Your Honour. No, I know. Because people just buck up the quality of their driving when they see police cars. They don't buck up the quality of their driving whenever they see average speed cameras. What they do is they drive below the average speed of the average speed cameras.
Yeah, and the problem is that when you stick average speed cameras out, you are targeting one thing and one thing only, and it is the incredibly easy, as well. I have moaned before on here, it's incredibly easy to quantify speed, and everyone likes something to be quantified. What's more difficult to quantify is someone driving like an idiot.
Yeah, absolutely.
That doesn't come on a nice little tick list of things people have done. Whereas, he was doing 35 when he should have been doing 30 is dead easy to come on a little tick list. And then you can go, speeding is the worst thing that happened, is the most prevalent thing that happens. No, I think you'll find the cause of the speeding was the person being an idiot.
Yeah.
More likely. And that's the most problematic thing with driving in Britain today. And the only way to be able to deal with that effectively is to have, as you've said, more transport or more traffic officers out there on the roads, witnessing it and talking to people. Because I expect with a lot of people that if you talk to them or an officer talked to them and said, look, do you know that you just did X, Y, and Z? That would be enough for them not to do that anymore.
Yeah. So I was in the Scottish police state over the weekend. Okay. And yes. Thou shalt not be better together over the weekend. And I was up at my parents, and my parents live in Perthshire, and they live not far from the A9. Now, the A9 from Dunblane to Inverness, at least from Dunblane to Inverness, is covered by average speed cameras right the way up there. Okay. I did not see an improvement in the quality of driving, thanks to the prolific number of average speed cameras keeping everyone at 60 or 70. What I saw was a lot of frustration and people zipping past and all the usual bad driving because the queues of traffic were so slow that people had plenty of latitude to make crazy, stupid, high-speed overtaking manoeuvres, which is the traditional issue with the A9. Now, ever since they introduced this setup a couple of years ago, 18 months, a year ago, whatever, and I have noticed there have been more and more reported accidents on the A9, thanks to boredom, thanks to fatigue, not thanks to an improvement in the quality of driving. People were still sitting in the outside lane at 65. They were still this meandering around, pulling silly manoeuvres. The Audi all-road drivers with the fishing rods from the front to rear strung over the cars were still driving like complete prat, just the same way as they were when I was driving it incredibly regularly 10 years ago. Okay? It just hasn't improved the stat driving standard. All it has done is made everyone drive badly more slowly. I think it's a mistake. I really like the quote from the Institute of Advanced Motoring's Neil Grieg, again quoted in Autocar, not a sponsor, where he said, roads with speeding problems or accident black spots should be targeted. Average speed cameras are expensive to install, so the money could be better spent on improving signage, lighting, and a number of other road safety features. Roads can be re-engineered to be safer, so options and permanent solutions need to be explored rather than a blanket average speed camera introduction. The merits of average speed cameras are apparent, and their compliance record is promising, but the idea of a blanket introduction to try to control drivers' speeding seems a more extreme solution than the problem warrants. Okay, so far so good. I agree with all of that. The bit that I really appreciate, I really agree with, is his last line here. The latest figures suggest that speed doesn't account for a large percentage of crashes, brackets 16%. Human error is usually more to blame. Okay, and the human error, the thing that really tightens up people's driving, are visible traffic cops. So give us the PCs on the road, bring out, roll out those 5 series estates, and let's see these guys on the road. Let's not go off and treat the symptom rather than the cause in all of this. And I don't even think we'd be treating the symptom particularly well.
No.
I'm on EV.
Yeah. No, totally agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. Should we move on from that one?
Yes. More awards.
Mm-hmm.
This time.
Yeah.
World Car Awards. They don't get much bigger than that.
Not really.
No.
Not really.
There were...
I think that sounds like a darned good set of awards, Andrew.
Well, I think they've possibly got one or two wrong.
Right.
No, I'm only kidding. Right, well, whilst Alan prepares himself and his acceptance speech on behalf of Mazda, the MX-5, and stands on the podium to accept the world's applause because the MX-5 won World Car of the Year, and people throw petals at his feet as he strides up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm actually happy it did win because it was up against the Audi A4, which seemed to be sweeping all in its path beforehand in other awards, and the Mercedes-Benz
mediocrity
GLC. Yes.
Yes, which is a rather weird one. There were some other notable finalists. BMW X1, Hyundai Tucson, Jaguar XE, Land Rover Disco Sport, Mazda CX-3, Skoda Superb, and the Toyota Prius were also up there in the... in the top 10, so credit to them as well in the top 10 for World Car of the Year. World Luxury Car of the Year was the BMW 7 Series. World Performance Car of the Year was the Audi R8 Coupe. It's just as well I don't vote in these things. World Car Design of the Year was the Mazda MX-5.
More thrown petals at Alan's feet.
Bow before me. Drivers of lesser vehicles. And the World Green Car of the Year, to mercifully round this off, is the Toyota Mirai, which, of course, is the hydrogen fuel cell car.
And second was the Prius.
Same was the Prius, the pure hybrid. Third was the Chevy Volt in there. And then the BMW 330e plug-in hybrid, which sounds interesting. And the last was the fifth was the Volkswagen Passat GTE, which I imagine is the electric version of the Passat. So
congratulations to Mazda.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Well done. Well done, Mazda. Once again, great work. Great work.
Anyway, Alan.
Yes!
We mentioned in the last show there was a reason we were in the same room.
Yes, there was. Yep.
And it wasn't just to scare each other so that we didn't actually look at each other while recording.
I know. It was more hesitant than normal. It was hilarious. Yeah.
No, I think...
apologies to that, folks.
I was shattered.
A couple of pints beforehand as well.
So, go on. Do you want to explain to the lovely listeners what the whole purpose was?
So, Graham and the team at Great Escapes Cars, who are a business that source, rent out, and provide classic cars, not just to punters in the street, but also to film and TV. You've probably seen some of their work if you watch. Was it Antiques? I want to say Antiques Roadshow. It's not Antiques Roadshow. I've forgotten the name of the show now. That's terrible.
No, it's the one that's on every evening around.
It's the one that's on every evening where they drive around in classic cars. Yeah. Basically, Great Escapes provide all the cars. For that. I'm sure Graham will correct me.
We will put the correct information in the show notes.
Yes. Antiques Road Trip.
That's
there
it.
There we go.
Yes.
I knew I'd get there eventually. My mom watches it. So she was all pleased. The other thing that they do is they do these driving days, which give you a great opportunity to drive a number of classics, normally about five, within one day. And a couple of times a year, they invite a whole load of bods who are vocal on Twitter and social media and just media stuff in general. And this time around, we were very, very lucky to both be invited.
We were.
So it was great. So we had five cars and a tour of the west of England and into Wales, out past Leinster, out towards Rhyder, across Keys and stuff, and then back into the west of England again. And it was an absolutely genius day out. It was really good. So we'd drive a bit, and then we'd choose a car pretty much at random from the car keys.
The hubcap of choice,
which was a little bit like some kind of, as Graham said, some kind of dodgy 70s parlor game, but mercifully we all got to keep our clothes on to pick stuff at random and then drive them for the next must have been about an hour each, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes it felt like much longer.
My driving so it was great. That bad,
and,
was it?
And again, that No. So it was great, and it was fab for us because we got to meet a whole bunch of people that we knew off the interwebs, but maybe hadn't met, or more in your case than mine, Andrew, meet up with people we've met up with before.
Yep.
And it was a great day out. And the selection of vehicles was huge. It was everything from sort of original Fiat 500s, Nuova 500s, right the way up to AC Cobra replicas and Capris and just all sorts of things. Mark II Jaguars. It was great. Really, yes. Fab choice. Beautifully arranged.
It did give us a nice selection of what they do offer. You know, we weren't just given the fast stuff. We weren't just given convertibles. It was they deliberately chose a nice selection of the cars they offer and what those different experiences would be.
80s to 60s, or was any of them 50s? I think the Mini counts as 50s. So it's right from the 50s right the way up and through, which was great.
Mm.
So what did we drive? We started off with Jag XJS.
Convertible. Yes.
Yes.
Wafting
it was
along.
Rather. Yes, it was a rather closer to navigation in some ways, instead of steering a frigate than driving. But it was a wonder. Do you know what I really liked about the XJS? And I think the whole day was actually about this, but what I loved about it was the fact that we're called Motoring Podcast, and the reason it's Motoring Podcast, whenever I was thinking of names some time ago before we'd even sort of worked out what the format should be, was that motoring is such a fantastic sounding word. You don't motor to work. You don't, you know, you drive to work. Driving's a slog. So motoring is something you do for fun and amusement. And I just felt that really, of all the cars we drove, the XJS was the one that was all about proper motoring. You know, it's yes. Motoring to the south of France.
Completely agree. You, yes, exactly. You could see with that car that you just chuck your bag in the boot and go, where should we go? Because we're not going to go there really, really fast.
No.
And we're going to enjoy the sights and smells as we go along. Maybe not all the smells. And
not all the smells, no. Not last Wednesday, yeah.
And that sort of thing. It was a relaxed atmosphere. When we were in that car, there was at no point when I was behind the wheel did I feel the urge, oh, I must push on. I just felt,
no,
we're going along at the speed we're going along, which wasn't slow.
No, it was ample sufficiency.
And this was just right for this moment, doing this thing. And it was lovely, because I've driven their coupe, and I loved that. Mm-hmm. I loved the because I'm old now, so I like comfort. I love the comfort and the smoothness and the way the suspension and the chassis just dealt with the bumps and lumps. Because you weren't thinking, this is a sports car, go around all the car corners fast, come on, go. You weren't thinking that. And I thought it was a great start to the day.
It was wonderful because you drove with your fingertips.
Mm.
I found myself driving with my fingertips, which I just thought was, I know that sounds ridiculous, but so much of the time when I'm driving, it's kind of either a dull slog or it's a little bit balls out. in the NX or in the Yaris. So it was just wonderful. I loved the XJS. I really, really did. To me, it was actually my favorite car of the day in total. And yeah, I declared that on the day it was my favorite car of the day, and I've been swithering a bit since, actually. And sort of thinking about stuff and changing my mind. But no, I really do think it was my car of the day. So we went from the sublime and sedate luxury of the XJS to something slightly different, didn't we?
Yes, very different.
Yes, a bit different. We ended up, our next selection from the hubcap of choice was the AC Cobra replica. And at the time, it really was driving, and it was driving with a capital D, and that this was a car. We went from something that was so sublimely relaxing to something which everything was hard work. It was
not relaxing.
It was manly steering. It was a manly gear shift. It was real. I mean, I had real trouble shifting gear for the first time here.
It was several manly gear shifts. It wasn't a man who needed to shift gear.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And for the first 10 miles, I couldn't shift gear properly. And I discovered the reason for that was that what I thought was pushing the clutch all the way down with a nice hard pedal travel was actually taking up the slack in the clutch, and I hadn't actually pushed it all the way down. I'm so used to driving super light Yaris and super light MX-5 that I was not ready for the force of 1,000 men that was needed to change gear in this darn thing.
But when you did get it right, when you realised you really needed to shove your left foot down, the gear change was lovely.
Yeah. It actually was.
And you could get it to be very slick once you worked it out. But I mean, this is the thing about when you swap from car to car is you have to quickly learn what the foibles are, I think that's another thing what the day was about, was showing us, reminding us that cars have a personality. They have their own little quirks and eccentricities. And you remember this when you go back to your first cars, that you go, oh yeah, I used to have to tap the, you know, the left-hand side of the dashboard on this one when it got a bit tricky round here, or before I came to this corner on the way home, I'd always have to knock it into this gear because it wouldn't react right. You know, it's all these little things that you got used to it and its personality and what the car was going to do and what the car was capable of doing. And that's what we were reminded of, I think.
Yeah, and we were warned at the beginning, of all the cars, this is the one that requires the most getting used to. And you know what? It's the car that I have thought about most since last Wednesday. It really is, because it was just such a... When you got it right, it was so great. And I really think that if it was something that you got used to and you spent time with, you would really, really grow to love. And just if once you know how to drive it, I think it'd be fantastic. I think it would be a scary, scary handful in the wet, but it was really great fun. It was really, really good. And that took us up to lunchtime. And then after lunchtime, basically I went groveling, cap in hand, or literally to the guys and said, look, can we just have anything as long as it's got a hard top? Because by that time we were bitterly cold, and that possibly explains why we're both as icky as we are at the minute. But we ended up with the Ford Capri 280 Brooklands.
Yes.
And
a heater.
You really loved that.
I did. I really enjoyed that. I was very comfortable straight away in that car, even with the brakes that were needed a little bit of encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was very happy with that, even with a massively long throw for the gears.
Yeah, it was a bit like a transit van gearbox for that long throw, but it was so period and so right for the.
I could imagine if you chuck a short shifter kit on that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could get yourself in some serious trouble.
Yeah, it made a great noise as well.
Oh, it did. It was. I really liked that one a lot. The steering was great. You put your foot down on the accelerator and everything happened. You know, it was, but it wasn't ridiculous.
No.
You know, it's, it wasn't so powerful that you sort of went, oh my God, you know, you put your foot down and, oh, we're moving away. There's not a little build up to it. It's like, no, everything happened as you expected it to happen. It was, you know, I was really surprised because I was worried that it was going to be one of those, don't go and meet, not quite meet your heroes, but you've heard such good things for so many years. And how many of those things have you heard are through rose tinted glasses? And you sort of go, oh, can it be anywhere near as nice and as fun? And we were on a, not a dreadfully wiggly bit, but a nicely wiggly bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could push it a lot, although we did encounter more than our fair share of roadworks.
Yes, we did. But in between the roadworks, ourselves and Television's Paul Woodford had a decent amount of open road as well.
Yes. But no, I like that one a lot. Then what did we move on to, Alan?
We moved on to a car that I wasn't expecting to like at all. We moved on an MGB JMGB. And actually, we ended up with two MGBs on the trot. So we ended up with a coupe, and then for reasons of hypothermia and time, we didn't get a shotty in the wee Fiat 500 because we wanted home by midnight. So we... well, it's true.
It is true. So I did put my foot down, I must admit.
Yeah, we did make progress in the MGB Roadster as well. And these were cars which their reputation did them down, quite significantly did them down. I always think MGB as sort of beady old men with flat caps and sheds. Really did. I always put them in straight into that category. And it was always a car I didn't really want. But what I found was, and please excuse me warbling on about the MX-5 once again, but it was really the MX-5's granddaddy. And that shouldn't have been a surprise to me. It shouldn't have been a surprise.
No, I should not have had to say that to you.
I know you shouldn't. And it's completely down to me and my own personal prejudices. But it was fab. It was all the bits I like about the MX-5, plus some of the things I'm really glad the reasons I drive an MX-5, not a classic MGB. But it was on the nice right bits of road. The steering was great. The go and the noise was similar. It was... I really liked both of them, actually. I preferred in the Roadster, which was much, much newer. But other than that, I liked the GT a lot, and I loved its looks. I just had never really concentrated on the looks as much as I did when I was taking some snappy snaps. And I actually think it was the best looking car of the day for me. Certainly of the ones we drove. I liked it an awful lot. Way more than I expected. Way, way more. So I'll stop waxing lyric on
that. No, I really enjoyed that car as well. I liked the size. The roads we were on were perfect for it as well.
Oh.
Because it was totally. Sort of we got A the and right B car road. At the right time. And it was... I preferred the GT to the drop top.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because I'm more of a hard top chap, but I felt I was sitting higher up in the convertible.
I agree with you. Again.
It's five now.
It's better than counting yawns.
Yes, quite. But I could see, and I said this to you on the day, I could see getting an MG and sort of resto modifying it where I'd put newer oily bits, better brakes, make sure the gearbox was in the best nick it could be in. I loved the overdrive because I'd never really driven with overdrive before, and I loved how that worked.
You got used to it. I'm sure there was a knack to making it a little bit smoother.
But I loved the change in tone of the engine when it engaged, because you sort of went from going, right, we're pushing along to, and we're now just going to chug along now. We're motoring now. We've gone from driving to motoring. That's how I felt the overdrive was. If we used it at the right time on the right bit of road.
Which took us a little while to get.
Yeah. And I think that's more our ability than anything else.
Yeah, totally.
But I loved the size of it, and I loved the dashboard. It was very simplistic. and we still had acres of room up front.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I really liked both those.
Yeah. Yeah. You really need to have a shot at the NX at some point. Really. Yeah. Whenever we meet up in May time, isn't it?
Mm.
Then definitely you need a shot of the MX to compare it to that, because I think you'd understand why I wax lyrical quite so much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a great car. Fantastic. We didn't get a chance to drive the ID Quattro, which I think would have been the newest feeling of all the cars.
And to be fair, we were in a queue. That pretty much was the one everybody wanted to try and drive.
It was, and it looked so good when we were behind it on the road. It just, the stance was fantastic.
Oh, it had the most presence there. I mean, even I thought it had more presence even than the Cobra, although the Cobra shouted more.
Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, there was a particularly excellent moment when we were in the Cobra and two Hercules happened to fly about 200 foot above us over the top.
You were nuts, and I was looking at the planes, not the car.
Yeah. That was a fairly memorable moment.
That was genius. Just outside Lancaster. Yeah. Absolutely right. Really good. If we whetted your appetite for something like that, then please get in touch with Great State Cars. We had an absolutely great time. They run about, was it 30 of them a year?
Yeah. But you can hire out for yourself on single days or over weekends and stuff like that. There'll be links in the show notes on how to get in touch with them. But if you fancy having a spin in a classic car, definitely give these guys a shout.
And please mention that you heard about them from here as yes, well. That would be fab as well.
That helps us to go on more of these things, so then we can pass on our experiences and expose you guys to more things that perhaps you hadn't considered before. So
yeah, I did. I'm considering it. Yeah, for my old man, actually, as a present. He doesn't listen, so I can get away with saying that. but yeah, it's something. That definitely is on the list to try and get some friends to share and experience that, because I've got a bunch of friends who probably really enjoy that kind of thing. One last thing, Andrew, before we finish up, something that you spotted.
Yes. Now, I've been to your house, Alan, and I know you need help in this area. You need what has just come out as a book, the How to Build Your Own Engine Coffee Table.
Yes, I'm trying to redecorate my sitting room. This may well be just the thing for me.
Now, I actually think this is quite a cool book. I know it sounds like I'm being pithy and everything, but
I'm taking the pith anyway.
Yeah. Yes, something like that. I think this is awesome. We all see these images and these things for sale where people go, oh, have a look at this X engine that's got a bit of glass on top, and that'll cost you lots and lots of pounds. Well, this book helps walk you through how to do it. And it's currently at 10 quid on Amazon. There's a link in the show notes. We don't have an affiliate link to Amazon, so you know that we'll declare that now. We don't have that, so this is, you know, we're not getting anything out of putting this link here. But I think the book's a great idea. And if you fancy tinkering or making something for your own house, your own flat, it talks about sheds and everything else, I think it'd be great.
Yeah. And it's easy enough to build, to pick up semi-knackered versions of even sort of what are listed as great engines via eBay and any of these or down your local scrappy. So the actual raw materials for this are not hugely expensive. To build a fantastic centerpiece for your sitting room. I may well end up in IKEA, but yeah, on the other hand, I may actually fork out on the coffee to see what's involved in doing this. So yeah, and it talks about how to, you know, plan, decide the right size of glass top, all that kind of fun stuff that you'd never even have considered and possibly made expensive mistakes around. So yeah, we saw that and thought that would be a pretty good one. That, I think, just about rounds it up for this week, doesn't it, mate?
I think it does.
Yep. So, before we go, just a quick reminder, folks, please, to actually rate and review us if you can. iTunes is the bestest place ever to do that if you can. It is the biggest podcast platform in the world. So if you can give us a rating, leave a comment on there, then that would be just great.
I think you're being very kind to our listeners here. We've gone a whole week without a lovely rating and review.
I know.
And frankly, I'm shocked and stunned, and I have to be honest with the listeners, disappointed.
Are you really disappointed?
I'm disappointed. I think they need to all go and take a good, long, hard look at themselves in the mirror.
Are you upset and let down as well?
I am. If I didn't have such a horrific cold, you could tell in my voice that I feel upset and let down. And I would hope by next week that many, many listeners will have gone and said, you know what, these chaps, they do try. We should go out and actually give them a little bit of a nod to say thank you. And we will go to iTunes that we already have.
Yeah.
And give them a quick rating and review. Because I can't imagine how I'm going to feel if we go 2 weeks without a rating and review.
I know. He will actually expire before next week's show. Now, some of you may see that as a positive.
There'll be tears and sobs, certainly.
But just remember, the alternative is an entire hour of me talking on my own. And that should be enough to make sure that you go and leave a rating or review. In all seriousness, guys, the charts on iTunes on any of these are not based purely on the number of downloads. They are based a lot on reviews and on the sort of peer thinking behind stuff. It is the best thing you can do to support this show, in actual fact, because it does give us that additional visibility. It's been great. We've spent the last couple of weeks in the What's Hot section of Automotive, and we really, really want to stay there. We really don't want to slip out of it. It's been fantastic for our numbers and our well-being in general, to be perfectly honest. So please, that'd be great. If you don't have access to iTunes or any of these things, if the podcasting app you're using allows you to leave ratings, to leave little love parts and stuff for us, then that would be just great. If you really want to leave one on iTunes, then please steal an iDevice off a friend. Use that to provide your surreptitiously subscribe them as well. Be just great. If you'd like to get in touch with us next Tuesday or Wednesday, then the hub of all our activity is on our website at www.motoringpodcast.com. The Motoring Podcast Twitter account is at Motoring Podcast, unsurprisingly. And the Motoring Podcast Instagram account, if you'd like to get in touch with us individually, then the best way to do that for me is to do it on Twitter at AJP Bradley. And Andrew, to get in touch with you?
The best way will be, again, via Twitter, where I am at Crack Windscreen.
It's good because he doesn't have to speak on Twitter. So, wrapping everything up for this week, next week, slightly different format. We've got a special surprise for you. But until then, I have been Alan Bradley.
I have just about been Andrew Clues.
He has actually survived to the end, but safe motoring.